Okay, continuing on tonight, we're going to finish the document I've been reading. We are going to start with chapter 10. A touch of social significance. Laws grind the poor, and rich men rule the law. That was said by Oliver Goldsmith. In case it should not yet be perfectly apparent, it may be worth stating here and now that the purpose of this inquiry into the law and its mysterious ways has not been and is not what today would be called a socially significant purpose. That is, it has not been to prove that the law, in terms of its results, oppresses the poor and favors the rich, and is a tool of big corporations, and is almost always found on the side of wealth, Wall Street, and the Republican Party. Practically every critical book on the law ever written attempts to prove just that, and there are hundreds of them. The trouble with them, with all of them, is not by any means that they are not, for the most part, quite right. The trouble is that they get just that far and no farther. Their authors, who are usually lawyers, have no basic quarrel with the law as a method, a science, a technique of running the world. They merely want to see it work for their side. They are not out to tear down the law. They are out to remodel it slightly so that its results suit them better. The purpose of this little inquiry has rather been to show that the whole pseudoscience of the law, regardless of its results, is a fraud. It is just as much of a fraud when it sends Dick Whitney to jail as it is when it sends to jail a starving man who steals a loaf of bread. It is just as much of a fraud when it favors sharecroppers or when it favors coupon clippers. It is just as much of a fraud when it protects civil liberties as when it protects the profits of holding companies. It is just as much of a fraud when handed down by a liberal court as when handed down by a conservative court. It is a fraud not because of its results, but because of the manner in which it purports to arrive at them. Yet no inquiry into the law could pretend to be complete without at least some slight consideration of the law's famous tautological boast about equal justice for all. For the boast is a lie. The law not only can be bought, although usually not in so direct a fashion as it was bought from ex-Judge Manton, but most of the time it has to be bought. And since it has to be bought, its results tend to favor those who can afford to buy it. Moreover, the fact that the law is constantly for sale, and generally to the highest bidder, ties right into the fact that the law as a whole is a fraud. For the law could not be bought, and it would not favor those who can afford to buy it, if the vaunted principles of which it is fashioned really were the ready keys to certainty and justice, which the lawyers claim them to be. It is because those principles are so many and so meaningless, because they can be chosen and twisted and sorted out to support any result under the sun, that the law does not produce justice, which in itself implies equality of treatment for all. In considering how and why the law has to be bought, it might be well to remember once more that the law is not the laws, as most people think of the laws. It is true that legislatures and members of Congress have been bought, or at least paid for, so that they would vote for or against proposed statutes, which would affect the interest of those who did the paying. But this practice, though deplorable, is a minor phenomenon compared to the day-in and day-out purchase of the law. For the law is that body of abstract, amorphous rules which supersede written statutes and even constitutions, and under which the lawyers and the lawyer judges resolve all our problems, settle all our disputes, and run all of our lives. It is well worth buying. How then is the law bought? How is it regularly turned to the account of those men and those companies who have money enough to pay what it costs? The law is bought, to put the answer bluntly and briefly right at the start, by hiring the services and the advice of the smartest lawyers, of the professional soothsayers, who are most adept at manipulating the principles of which the law is made. It is bought by paying premium in court and out of court to the 20th century medicine men who can best cast spells of legal language to protect and defend the personal and financial interests of those who would be hard put to protect and defend such interest in terms of justice undiluted by law. Now, most people, if they think at all about what money can do in the way of legal protection, think exclusively about criminal law. They think about Leopold and Loeb being able to hire Clarence Darrow to keep them from the electric chair. They think about the Mitchells and the Insulls, the captains of industry who get caught doing strange things with other people's money, and who can then buy the services of the cleverest and yet most respectable members of the bar to save them from legal punishment. People contrast such goings-on with what happens daily to the ordinary murderers and ordinary thieves who can only afford the cut-rate prices charged by poorer lawyers, or who have to have their lawyers supplied them free and third-rate, just so that the outward appearance of the justice for all ceremony may be maintained. And most people realize that there is something distinctly unfair about all this. There is, but it is only a very small part of the story. In the first place, criminal cases, although they take up most of the newspaper space devoted to the law, take up only a fraction of the time of the courts. The bulk of the business of the courts is given over to what the lawyers call civil suits, in which one person sues another person, or one company sues another company, usually over some financial or business squabble. In these cases, just as in criminal cases, and it is particularly noticeable when a corporation is on one side of the dispute and a lone individual on the other, the most money buys the best legal assistance. And the better your legal assistance, the better your chance of ending up with the law in your favor. For as cannot be repeated too often, the law is not by several long shots the certain and exact science as which it masquerades. If it were, even the richest corporation in existence would not throw its money away on the tremendous fees that the leading lawyers charge their clients. Any lawyer, or perhaps no lawyer at all, would do just about as well. But the corporations know, and the lawyers know, that a master manipulator of legal mumbo jumbo is a far more useful thing to have on your side in a lawsuit than all the certain and impartial justice in the world. True, in a great many legal disputes, there will seem to be more principles of law, or more compelling in the abstract principles of law, available to one side than to the other. But the other side will always have some principles left to play with. And just as in the game of bridge, so in the game of law, an expert player will beat a run-of-the-mill player 9 times out of 10, despite the fact that he may hold worse cards. Yet it is not only and not chiefly in the purchase of smart counsel to represent you in actual court cases that the law has to be bought. The law, although it oversees all human affairs, does not apply itself automatically to the settlement of human grievances. The man who thinks he is being cheated in a personal or business way, who thinks he is being deprived of his just rights so clearly that it is even a violation of the legal system of far-fetched principles, must go to court to try to get any satisfaction at all from the law. And it costs money to go to court. It costs money even before the bills for lawyers' fees begin to come in. That is why most people never in all their lives become plaintiffs in a lawsuit. Farmers and factory workers and housewives and unemployed people have their legal grievances just as rich men and big corporations have their grievances. But they cannot afford to buy so much as a shot at the law. A man who is pretty sure the agreement he made is being broken when a finance company takes away his car or his radio because a couple of payments have been delayed would not think of hiring a lawyer and going to court about it. It costs too much. A clerk in a big department store who thinks that some new government statute hits him in an unfair and perhaps illegal way would not dream of going to court about it. But the store would go in a minute if it felt cheated by some written law. A workman's wife who is desperately unhappy with her husband and has perfectly adequate grounds for divorce will not sue for one. Divorce is like suits against the government and legal efforts to get a fair deal in ordinary business arrangements, and like almost every other kind of law case in the book, are the exclusive luxuries of those, and there are very few of them, who have money enough to pay for the law. A several million dollar corporation recently complained in print about the terrific cost of carrying to and through the courts a protest against a ruling of the National Labor Relations Board. The point was well taken, yet it serves quite nicely to emphasize the utter helplessness of the ordinary man with a grievance that he would like to expose to the law. The corporation at least could and did afford to pay the thousands of dollars necessary to get a legal hearing on the wrong that it thought had been done it. But what chance, for instance, would an employee or a customer of the corporation have to air his complaint in court as he thought he had been unfairly and illegally treated by the U.S.? Okay, by the U.S. government, or for that matter, by the corporation itself. The disadvantages of the corporation up against the U.S. government in a matter involving the law are as nothing compared to the advantages the corporation holds over every individual who works for it, buys from it, or invests in it, wherever the law is or might be concerned. Still, it is not in buying smart soothsayers to talk for you in court, nor even in buying your way into court in the first place, that the law is most commonly and most effectively sold and purchased. Most of the business that lawyers handle and live on is made up of matters that never get near a courtroom. Most of the business that lawyers handle and live on is made up of what is called legal advice, usually about financial matters, that is tendered at a price to those men and those companies that feel it will be well worthwhile to get the law safely on their side before they embark on any money-making or money-saving deals of any kind. Any legal advice amounts, for the most part, to casting spells of legal language over the wording of business documents so that the documents, if they ever should be dragged into court, will show that regardless of where non-legal justice may seem to lie, the law is pretty clearly on the side that bought the legal advice. To take a very simple example, suppose a man should set up a parking lot and hand out plain numbered tickets, like the checks you get when you check your hat in a restaurant, to everyone who parks his car in the lot. Suppose a woman should park her car and leave her fur coat in the back seat and should come back to find the fur coat gone. Suppose, moreover, that she should be mad enough and wealthy enough to sue the parking lot owner for the loss of her coat. The chances are strong that the law, after tossing abstract principles around in profusion, might hold him responsible for the loss and make him pay her the value of the coat. Yet most people who lose articles out of cars left in parking lots have scarcely a Chinaman's chance of getting a cent out of the lot owners. Most parking lots are owned by people or companies with money enough to buy legal advice beforehand. And so most parking checks are not plain pieces of cardboard with numbers on them. They have numbers on them, all right, but on the back of the check or at the bottom is printed in small type, "The owner of the car covenants that the bailee will not be held liable or responsible for the loss, theft, and or damages of articles, etc., or words to that effect, courtesy of the legal advice, the law has been carefully placed on one side of the potential lawsuit, without so much as the knowledge of one of the parties to the contract that it has been placed there, just in case." It is the same on a much larger and more complicated scale with leases. It is the same with mortgages. It is the same with insurance policies. It is the same with stock issues and bond issues and all the other legal devices by which business concerns of all kinds and shapes earn, beg, borrow, or steal other people's money to use for themselves. There is always that big block of small type, sometimes running to several pages, which the ordinary purchaser or tenant or borrower or lender or investor does not bother to read and probably could not understand if he did read it. That block of small type is put there at the advice of lawyers. And what it means is that if there is any trouble that should arise over the little business arrangement, the ordinary purchaser or tenant or borrower, or lender, or investor is almost surely going to lose if he should be fool enough to carry his complaint to the law. For the other fellow, the company or the individual with money enough to afford it has been canny enough to buy the law in advance. Of course, it often happens in the world of finance and industry that both sides of a business deal are able to hire legal advice right from the start. That is the lawyer's heyday. Counsel for each side, without so much as a minor lawsuit anywhere in prospect at the time, will fight to outdo each other in the clever manipulation of legal language and the careful building of legal fences so that their client's interests may later be defended, if necessary, in strict accordance with principles of law. Yet unless one set of lawyers is much smarter than the other set of lawyers, both sides might just as well dispense with their lawyers altogether, so far as driving a reasonable and profitable and fair business bargain is concerned. The hitch is that as soon as one side resorts to legal advice, the other side has to use it too, in self-defense. Thus, everybody loses except the lawyers who go merrily on selling the law. But since most business transactions involve a big fellow and a little fellow, a company, for instance, that can afford legal advice and a customer who can't. The law is usually weighted to one side from the very beginning. It is weighted by lining up beforehand in the written terms of the transaction the legal language that will fit right into legal principles in any lawsuit that might later arise out of the transaction. And it is in this fashion, even more than by the hiring of smart word jugglers to represent you in court or by the purchase of a court hearing to begin with, that the law is regularly bought and therefore regularly tends to favor those with money enough to buy it. That is why the center of the nation's law business is in New York City, and why the bulk of the nation's influential and profitable law practices carried on in the Wall Street law factories. People and companies in other parts of the country have their legal grievances and disputes and their court squabbles, and they have them in much greater proportion than the proportion of the nation's law business that is carried on outside New York. But the richest people and the biggest companies make almost all of their financial arrangements and their important business deals in New York. And financial arrangements and important business deals, even more than actual legal disputes, are what the lawyers thrive on. Most New York lawyers spend most of their time working out legal advice for the business titans that make their financial headquarters in the city. It may be advice about how to word a series of mortgages or conditional sale contracts or leases or stock certificates so that the little fellows on the other side of the deals will have little or no chance for legal redress if they should later feel themselves cheated. It may be advice about an intercorporate transaction where the sole real usefulness of the advice will be to counter any tricks of legal language that the other side, also advised by high-paid lawyers, might try to pull. It may be advice about how to get around a bothersome government regulation and still keep on good terms with the law, which, of course, is more almighty than any government regulation. Advice that thousands of smaller companies or less wealthy people would love to have, too, if only they could afford it. It may be advice about how to make use of legal language so as to get out of paying taxes, as when J.P. Morgan, for all his yacht and his grouse shooting, perfectly legally avoided the federal income tax for a couple of years, while hundreds of thousands of $1,500 a year men had to chip in to the U.S. Treasury. In any case, it will be advice which has a dollars and cents value to the person or the company that buys it, somewhat greater than the stiff price the lawyers charge for it. And the direct or indirect losers in the whole affair will be the companies and people by the millions who cannot afford thus to buy the law. There is no more striking parody of the law's boast that it represents equal justice for all than in the work of those top men of the legal trade who cluster and prosper in New York City. Moreover, most good lawyers go to New York before they die. They go to New York because that is where they can make the most money out of their knack of tossing around legal principles and legal language. As a matter of fact, herds of them are coaxed straight to New York from the law schools every year. And thus, incidentally, the profession gets in another telling blow for the perpetuation of the legal legend. For whatever slight doubts about the reasonableness, practicability, and magistry of the legal process may have been left in the smart youngsters' heads, after 3 years of rigid drilling in the sacredness of abstract concepts, quickly evaporate in an atmosphere where the law is acknowledged king, and the king and his pet courtiers are so handsomely rewarded. Here, too, is the kernel of another reason why the law is kinder to the rich than to the poor. Not only are the most promising young hocus-pocus artists immediately lured to the service of those who pay them the highest wages for the magic, but out of this group spring eventually and almost automatically most of the acknowledged leaders of the profession. For as in other trades and professions, earning capacity is universally and blindly accepted as the hallmark of real ability. Benjamin Franklin once paid tribute to this fact when he suggested that the lawyers appoint the judges on the ground that they would always pick the ablest of their clan so that they might most profitably divide each new judge's practice among themselves. And despite the fact that Franklin's scheme has never been put to the direct test, it is out of the acknowledged leaders of the profession who are acknowledged to be leaders because they make so much money that most judges are chosen. Now, when a lawyer becomes a judge, he no longer has a direct financial incentive to manipulate the law in favor of the rich people and the big corporations. But he will usually have spent most of his professional life before he became a judge doing just that. What is more, he will not have admitted, even to himself, that he was doing anything other than apply an exact and impartial science to the orderly management of men's affairs. In inevitable protection of his own self-esteem, he will perforce have swallowed most of the legal legend whole, and consequently he will have hardened into a habit of mind whereby justice and the legal principles he is used to using are just about synonymous. When he becomes a judge, he cannot easily shake off this slant, this set slant toward the law. The principles and concepts he once flung about and fought for, mouthed now by other lawyers trying cases before him, will still have a familiar and authoritative ring. Such phrases as freedom of contract and caveat emptor, and the sanctity of written, by lawyers, agreements, and deprivation of property without due process, along with all the minor and equally vague abstractions with which lawyers customarily defend in and out of court the interests of their wealthy clients, will strike the eyes and ears of the judge as good, sound legal doctrine. By contrast, the phrases and principles of law customarily used to argue against such interests will seem less familiar, less orthodox, less compelling. Conditioned by his own past habits of legal speech and thought, the judge will unconsciously lean in laying down the law toward the side that talks his old brand of legal dialect, which means that he will lean toward the side where the money lies, and the law will lean with him. There is one more important reason why the law regularly tends to favor the rich, the conservatives, the people and companies with plenty of money and property who unnaturally want to keep all their money and property and keep on getting more of it in the same old ways. This reason is inherent in the very nature of the law itself. For the law, you may remember, purports to be a great body of changeless abstract truths. Times change, and ways of living change, and the facts of human affairs change. But the principles of the law remain unmoved and steadfast. In short, the law, by its own definition, is a stand-pat science. And, of course, it is the wealthy and well-to-do who are always stand-patters. The poor and the not-so-well-to-do are the progressives and the radicals. The moneyed groups are, for the most part, very nicely satisfied with the old arrangement of things. Justice or no justice, in the original Christian sense of the word, They don't want to see the rules shifted in the game of getting ahead in the world. And they find in the law a philosophical and less obviously selfish defense of the resistance to change. They also find in the law something more solid and more useful than a philosophical defense of conservatism. For the law, mysteriously brought to earth by lawyers and judges, does control all earthly affairs. And in being transmuted from abstract principles into specific decisions about human disputes and problems, it retains its reactionary flavor. New rules of the game, new arrangements in men's activities, new considerations of what is practical and what is fair, fit less smoothly and less snugly into the law's scheme of principles than do the old considerations, the old arrangements, the old rules. That is one reason why so much progressive legislation, meaning laws that try to change the rules to favor the poor at the expense of the rich, is either damned entirely or interpreted into ineffectiveness by the courts. The novel arrangements just don't slide easily into the old, unchanging principles of law. For instance, the newfangled notion that a worker ought to be paid a living wage didn't stand a chance when it first came up against the age-old law-encrusted right of a corporation to pay its workers as little as it pleased. There might have been a law about that, but the law had never heard of such a thing. Similarly, the idea that a homeless man might be legally justified in breaking into an empty house to sleep, an idea that could certainly be argued from the standpoint of pure, unadulterated justice, would be laughed out of court today. As would the idea that a bond salesman whose glib assurances had led an old lady to invest her savings could be sued by the old lady for what she lost when the bonds later became worthless. For the judges will not, if they can't help it, go to the trouble of reshuffling the law's huge deck of abstract principles in order to reach and rationalize a radically different set of practical results. Only rarely and reluctantly will they turn the stream of legal logic in a really new direction. Only rarely and reluctantly will they tolerate in the law's name far-reaching or basic changes in the manner of adjustment of human problems. Thus, not only the law, but the general trend of legal decisions remains the same. And by remaining the same, it favors the interests of those who stand to benefit by a retention of the old rules. It favors the conservatives. It favors the rich. Yes, the socially significant books about the inequalities and injustices of the law in action are right as far as they go. And incidentally, a prominent member of the bar recently summed up a large part of their theme in a phrase when he described the ideal client, the lawyer's dream, as a rich man who is scared to death. But still, it is the fact that the law as a whole is a fraud that lies behind all the inequalities and all the injustices. It makes it worthwhile for those with money enough to afford it to buy the court services and the pre-court advice of those mumbo-jumbo chanters and scribblers who can best wring desired results out of legal language and legal principles. It makes it worthwhile for those with money enough to afford it to buy their way into court if the results they want wrung out of the law cannot be otherwise attained. It is responsible for the myopic inability of most judges to see beyond the one-sided principles they used to use when their own services were for sale to the highest bidders. It is responsible for the inherent inertia, the congenital conservatism of the law in action. For if the law were really the exact and impartial science it purports to be, instead of being an uncertain and imprecise abracadabra devoted to the solemn manipulation of a lot of silly abstractions, none of these bases of inequality and injustice would or could exist. The law is indeed a menace when it works so as to pervert its own boast of equal justice for all, when it favors the rich and oppresses the poor, when its results in the mass or in the particular seem to be plain denials of ordinary non-legal impartiality and fairness. The point is that even when the law works, as it sometimes does, so as to produce fair and impartial and practical results, it is nothing but an unnecessary and expensive nuisance. Those results might have been achieved much more simply and easily and painlessly without recourse to the metaphysical nonsense of the law. And it is the point which the socially significant boys invariably miss. The socially significant plot has grown stale in the telling. It always revolves around the conventional triangle of the rich, the poor, and the law. And the villain always walks off with Lady Law in the end, which is supposed to show that she is a villain too, whereas actually she is only an empty-headed fool who neither knows nor could be taught any better. Chapter 11. Let's lay down the law. The first thing we do, let's kill all the lawyers. That was said by William Shakespeare. What is ever to be done about it? What is ever to be done about the fact that our business, our government, even our private lives are supervised and run according to a scheme of contradictory and nonsensical principles built of inherently meaningless abstractions? What is to be done about the fact that we are all slaves to the hocus pocus of the law and to those who practice the hocus pocus, the lawyers? There is only one answer. The answer is to get rid of the lawyers and throw the law with a capital L out of our system of laws. It is to do away entirely with both the magicians and their magic and run our civilization according to practical and comprehensible rules dedicated to non-legal justice, to common or garden fairness that the ordinary man can understand in the regulation of human affairs. It is not an easy nor a quick solution. It would take time and foresight in planning, but neither can it have been easy to get rid of the medicine men in tribal days, nor to break the stranglehold of the priests in the Middle Ages, nor to overthrow feudalism when feudalism was the universal form of government. It is never easy to tear down a widely and deeply accepted set of superstitions about the management of men's affairs. But it is always worth trying, and given enough support, the effort will always succeed. You can fool some of the people all the time, etc. The difficulty lies only in convincing enough people that they are being fooled. Nor is this in any sense a plea for anarchy. It would not be necessary to do away with constitutions or statutes or with the orderly settlement of disputes and problems in order to do away with the lawyers and their law. It would only be necessary to do away with the present manner of phrasing and later interpreting written laws and with the present manner of settling disputes and solving problems. It would only be necessary to do away with all the legal language and all the legal principles which confuse instead of clarifying the real issues that arise between men. This is not a plea for anarchy. It is rather a plea for common sense. And the first step toward common sense is a realization that certainty and consistency, or any close approximation to them, is utterly impossible in the supervision of men's affairs. It is in its refusal to recognize or accept this fact that the law makes its gravest and most basic error. It preens itself as being both certain and consistent. It purports to have a sure answer ready for application to any factual problem or squabble that may arise. Yet even a cursory examination is enough to show that the law's alleged certainty and consistency lie entirely in the never-never land of abstract principles and precepts. The law has been forced to retreat from the world of facts into its own world of fantasy in order to maintain the pose that it is a precise and solid science. Moreover, it is in feigning certainty and consistency in the settlement of flesh and blood problems while striving desperately to keep up the illusion in the irrelevant realm of legal abstractions that the law has lost touch with justice unadorned. As mentioned before, justice can't be cut up into convenient categories. And the law, in reaching for certainty with one hand and justice with the other, has fallen between the two into a morass of meaningless and useless language, as though any actual dispute could be settled either certainly or justly by reference to the words, consideration is essential to a valid contract, or to the words, no state may constitutionally tax property outside its jurisdiction. Since certainty and consistency are impossible of attainment in the orderly control of men's affairs, the sensible thing to do would seem to be to go straight after justice in the settlement of any specific question that comes up for solution. Now, justice itself is conceded an amorphous and uncertain ideal. One man's justice is another man's poison. But that is where written laws come in. Wherever different people's different ideas about what is fair and what is right clash head on, written laws enacted by democratic processes should contain, insofar as possible, the answer. Wherever written laws cannot or do not contain the answer, somebody has to make a decision. And that decision might better be made on grounds of plain, unvarnished justice, fairness, humanitarianism, amorphous though it may be, than on any other. Today it is the lawyer judges who make such decisions. Even when some part is taken by a jury, that last and waning vestige of recognition that the ordinary man's ideas about justice are worth something, the jury has to act within the rigid framework of the law and the judge's orders. But the ordinary man knows as much about justice as does the judge. As a matter of fact, he usually knows more, for his ideas and ideals about human conduct are more simple and direct. They are not all cluttered up with a lot of ambiguous and unearthly principles, nor impeded by the habit of expressing them in a foreign language. A training in the law cannot make any man a better judge of justice, and it is all too likely to make him a worse one. But there is one kind of training, one kind of knowledge that can fit a man to handle more ably and more fairly the solution of specific human problems. In any common sense system, that kind of training and that kind of knowledge, instead of adeptness in the abstract abracadabra of the law, would be a prerequisite to the right to sit in judgment on another man's affairs. The kind of knowledge that could be really useful, that would really equip a man for the job of solving specific problems fairly, is technical, factual knowledge about the activities out of which the problems arise. Not that such knowledge would impart a keener sense of justice. Rather, that such knowledge would enable him to understand the problems themselves more clearly, more intimately, and more thoroughly, and therefore to apply his sense of justice to their solution in a more intelligent and more practical way. A mining engineer could handle a dispute centering around the value of a coal mine much more intelligently and therefore more fairly than any judge untrained in engineering can handle it. A doctor could handle a dispute involving a physical injury much more intelligently and therefore more fairly than any judge untrained in medicine can handle it. A retail merchant could handle a business dispute between two other retail merchants much more intelligently and therefore more fairly than any judge can handle it. A man trained in tax administration could have handled Senior versus Braden much more intelligently and therefore more fairly than the Supreme Court handled it. In short, even discounting for the moment the encumbrances of legal doctrine that obstruct the straight thinking processes of every judge, the average judge is sadly unequipped to deal intelligently with most of the problems that come before him. And why, after all, should not the orderly solution of our business and government and private difficulties, practical problems all, be entrusted to men who have been trained to understand the practical problems and to appreciate the difficulties? Why should we continue to submit our disputes and our affairs to men who have been trained only in ethereal concepts and abstract logic, and who persist in pursuing that will-o'-the-wisp certainty? Why should we keep on sacrificing both justice and common sense on the altar of legal principles? Why not get rid of the lawyers and their law? It would take, of course, a peaceful revolution in the system of rules under which we live. Constitutions, in part at least, would have to be rewritten without benefit of lawyers. Why not? The machinery exists for doing it in an orderly and peaceful way. Where constitutional commands and prohibitions make sense to the average man, they could be kept unchanged. Anyone understands, for instance, that the federal Constitution's requirement of a census every 10 years means what it means. Where constitutional commands and prohibitions are completely incomprehensible, except in the light of legal interpretation, they should be clarified so that they do make sense or else omitted entirely. Why should the lawyers have a monopoly on the understanding of any part of any constitution? Statutes would all have to be redrafted too, again, without benefit of lawyers. And that would be a tougher job, but by no means an insuperable one. The lawyers themselves have done it often with a whole body of written laws. They call it codifying the laws. There is no reason why a chosen group of non-lawyers should not codify the present laws of every state and of the federal government as well, and codify them so that it no longer takes a lawyer to translate them into significance. Any law that means something definite and tangible in relation to human affairs can be written so that its meaning is plain for all to read. Any law that means nothing except as lawyer and lawyer judges put content into its inherently contentless language has no business staying on the books. Furthermore, any law which, instead of laying down rules itself, turns over the solution of certain factual types of problems to a group of experts or administrators, should say perfectly frankly what it is doing, what it's doing, and should define in factual instead of legal language the field within which the experts are to make rules and decisions. Why conceal behind vague generalities the fact that the Securities and Exchange Commission has been given within vague limits the power to make rules for the running of the New York Stock Exchange? Why not make the granting of power simple and direct? And why not make the limits of the power specific instead of leaving their determination to the lawyer judge's subsequent and haphazard interpretation of the statute's legal language? Similarly, any written law which, though laying down a broad rule, leaves to a court or some such deciding body the precise application of its rule to the fact of any particular problem, should say that it is doing just that. First-degree murder is punishable by death. Makes no real sense as a statute, because first-degree murder makes no sense except in relation to the abstract legal principles which are said to define it. When a court, whether judge or jury or both or some other kind of deciding body, finds that one person has killed another person and believes that the killer deserves to be electrocuted, the court may order that he be electrocuted, is equally descriptive of the rule and much more accurate. Why not phrase the statute that way, so everyone would know just what it did mean? Then, if we should want the rule to be more precise, the written law could be made more precise. Instead of pretending that the words first-degree murder contribute toward preciseness or toward anything but obscureness and unintelligibility. For, of course, there would still have to be courts or judges or decision makers under any orderly system of social control, even though written laws were made intelligible to all. There would have to be decision makers to determine the true facts behind any dispute, and then to apply to the dispute the terms of any written laws, whether those laws were so precise that their application was almost automatic, or whether they left room for the decision makers to exercise their own discretion and their own sense of justice. There would have to be decision makers, too, to settle any disputes which were not covered by written laws. And it is as decision makers that men trained in the technicalities of factual problems rather than in the technicalities of legal language come in. Suppose today a problem in the regulation of utility rates comes before a court of law. The company will argue that its property is worth a great deal of money because the more money it is worth, the higher rates it can charge, since it is allowed to make a fair return on the reasonable value of its investment. The Utility Commission, out to defend the rates it ordered the company to charge, will argue that the company's property is worth considerably less than the company's figure. Both the company and the commission will bring in engineers and accountants to testify about the value of the company's property. The company's experts will set a high figure, and the commission's experts will set a low figure. And the court, unable to understand or gauge intelligently the basis of either set of figures, will more than likely split the difference and let it go at that. But why? If the commission, which is a government body, just like any court, is not to have the last word in applying a written law entrusted to it for enforcement, should not the dispute at least be brought before a court of engineers or accountants, or both, who, unpaid by either side, could apply their technical knowledge to an examination of both sets of claims and an intelligent choice between them? Suppose today a man accused of a crime pleads before a court of law that he is insane and therefore cannot be held responsible. The prosecuting attorney will produce psychiatrists who insist and explain in medical terms why they insist that the defendant is sane. The defendant's attorney will produce psychiatrists who insist and explain in medical terms why they insist that the defendant is crazy. The court will listen uncomprehendingly to both sets of psychiatrists and will then go into a huddle with itself over the question whether the accused man can understand the difference between right and wrong? If he can, he is sane according to the law. And if he can't, he is sane according to the law. So no matter how ridiculous the basis of distinction may seem, and does seem, to any psychiatrist, but why should not the dispute be brought immediately before a court of psychiatrists or before a single psychiatrist judge who, unpaid by either side, could apply technical knowledge to an examination of the defendant's claim and make an intelligent decision as to its validity? Suppose today a complicated dispute over the internal management of a corporation comes before a court of law for a solution. Lawyers for both sides will defend their clients' actions and interests in elegant legal language. The court, in making its decision, will choose between two proffered sets of legal principles. Why legal language and legal principles? Why not considerations of business efficiency and business ethics? And why should not the dispute be brought before a court of men experienced in corporate management, who could apply their technical knowledge to an examination of the claims of both sides and to an intelligent and practical as well as fair solution of the difficulty? It is no answer to say that a lawyer judge understands better than does an engineer or an accountant or a psychiatrist or a business executive the other issues involved in these cases or in any other of a thousand types of cases that might be named. The only real issue ever involved in any case is the intelligent formation of a fair decision to a factual problem, either within the framework of some relevant written law, or if necessary, without reference to any written law. The only understanding helpful in formulating such a decision, granted that the words of any relevant statute make sense, and if they don't, they should be ignored, is a practical understanding of the problem involved. An engineer or an accountant or a psychiatrist or a business executive, remember, has just as keen and impartial a sense of justice where his own interests are not concerned as has any judge where his interests are not concerned. Moreover, if two or more kinds of specialized knowledge are pertinent to the settlement of any problem, why should not two or more kinds of technical experts compose the court which settles the problem? Why, in any case, should the real issues ever be obscured by the fake issues of the law? In any common sense system of social control or government, the courts, the law applying and decision making bodies, would be built of men trained to an understanding of the different fields of human activity with which they were to deal. The exact mechanics of such a scheme could be worked out in any one of several ways. Perhaps permanent courts of experts in different fields of practical knowledge might be set up, each to handle all disputes and problems that centered around their own fields. Perhaps instead of taking men permanently away from the work to which they had been trained and making specialized judges out of them, there might be panels of experts on call for part-time court service in the settlement of disputes involving their separate fields of knowledge. Perhaps, for any such scheme would have to include a central directing bureau to arrange for the hearing of each case before the right court. There might be central courts composed of a dozen different kinds of specialists, an ex-business executive and an ex-doctor, and an ex-labor leader, and an ex-engineer, and an ex-banker, and an ex-farmer, and an ex-public administrator, and so forth. And each central court might assign the handling of every case that came before it among its own members or among other specialists it had available for service, or among a relevant combination of the two. Perhaps each field of dispute might have its own central court and its own outside part-time judges. Thus, a central criminal court might include an ex-penologist, an ex-financial expert, an ex-doctor, and an ex-police official, and a couple more, with a chemist and a psychiatrist and a ballistics expert, among others, on call to sit in certain cases where their special knowledge would be of help. Even the Supreme Court, composed, of course, of non-lawyers, and this, incidentally, would not even require an amendment to the Constitution, which says not a word about the judges having to be lawyers, might well make use of outside specialists as part-time judges. And since most of the problems that come before the Supreme Court involve and would probably continue to involve practical problems in government, most of its members, as well as the members of any other courts devoted to handling such problems, would be men trained and qualified in the efficient and wise administration of government affairs. As a matter of fact, abolition of the lawyers and their law might eventually lead to the virtual disappearance of courts as we know them today. Every written law, written, you remember, in a comprehensible language, might be entrusted to a body of technical experts to administer and apply it and make specific decisions under it. As the Interstate Commerce Commission applies the Interstate Commerce Act, as the Federal Trade Commission applies the Clayton Act, so each state would have, say, a killing commission to apply its laws about what are now called murder and manslaughter. Moreover, the decision of the technical experts who made up each commission would be final. There would be no appeals and super appeals to other bodies of men who knew and understood less about the real matter in dispute than the original deciders. There would be a Supreme Court or a Supreme Commission or such to settle important intergovernmental or intragovernmental squabbles, to which the written laws did not contain the ready answer. But just about all that would be left for courts or something like our present courts to handle would be disputes to which no written laws directly applied. And where no written laws directly applied, arbitration of the dispute by picked specialists in that field or that business would serve the ends of efficiency, justice, and also economy far better than a formal trial before any kind of court. But even the remote idea of the eventual disappearance of our courts has a shocking sound. It is only because of our blind faith that the mysterious processes of the law do somehow work inexorably towards certain justice. Well, for the 10th time, they don't. When the courts happen to produce justice, it is as likely to be despite the irrelevant processes of the law as because of them. Nor, for all the legal legend, are judges infallible arbiters of right and wrong, fair and unfair. Judges are men, not gods. Moreover, they are government servants, government employees. Why should not another group of men, another group of government employees, be equally able to decide what is fair and what is unfair? Why should not another group of men given equal responsibility and trained to an understanding of complicated practical problems be better able to decide what is fair and what is unfair within the limits of an intelligible statute than those who have been trained mainly in the manipulation of abstract principles? Why should not a commissioner's word be as good as a judge's word? True, the mechanics of any such system, as has been suggested to replace the lawyer judges, would be complicated in the extreme, but no more complicated than the present confusing, overlapping, and wasteful hierarchy of trial courts and appellate courts, state courts and federal courts, courts of law and courts of equity, police courts and magistrates courts, common pleas courts and special claims courts, and all the rest, all of them manned by exalted lawyers. And if the whole idea of taking the settlement of our disputes and problems in one fashion or another out of the hands of the lawyer judges sounds too fantastic, too far-fetched and unfeasible, a couple of little points are worth considering. For small steps in that direction have already been in the field been made in the field of government and also in the field of business. In the field of government, the growth of commissions and boards and all sorts of administrative bodies has served to deprive the courts of law of some of the decision-making business that used to be theirs. Today, most new statutes are put in the charge of special decision-making agencies instead of being entrusted directly to the courts for interpretation and application. It is true that today an appeal to a court can always be taken from any commission's decision, but the commission really stands in the place of a trial court, and appeals are comparatively few. It is true, too, that these commissions are now usually manned in large part by lawyers, but even the lawyer commissioners are coming more and more to be chosen for their familiarity with the practical problems with which the commission has to deal, rather than for their adeptness at the law. At the least, it is a trend. In the field of business, the first halting step away from the lawyer judges has been the growth of arbitration as a means of settling disputes. Arbitration means nothing more than the voluntary turning over of a dispute for fair settlement to a man or group of men, trusted by both sides and equipped by specialized knowledge to understand the question at issue. Lawyers are not necessary, either as arbitrators or as advisors, and experience has proved that their presence is all too likely to hold up and confuse the whole proceedings. They just can't forget their abstract principles, nor their pleading and procedure, and get down to business. Most judges, incidentally, disapprove heartily of arbitration, and say so whenever they get a chance in a lawsuit, as when a contract provides for it. They well know in what direction arbitration as a system is heading. As a matter of fact, go back for a minute to the possible mechanics of setting up substitutes for the present courts of law. One scheme might be the tremendous extension of the arbitration device. Thus, the two sides in what the law would call a civil suit, an ordinary case not involving the government, might be required to pick their own expert or experts to settle their dispute for them, perhaps from among a qualified list of arbitrators in that field, or perhaps not. Certainly, such a requirement would fit in perfectly with the complete abolition of courts as we know them, with the use of commissions or such to decide matters arising under written laws. For all disputes not covered by a written law, they could be turned over to arbitration. At any rate, regardless of the exact details or mechanics, the important thing in any common sense system would be to get rid of the abracadabra of the law as an alleged basis for the settlement of human and social problems. That would mean cleaning all the vague and essentially meaningless legal language out of constitutions and statutes. It would mean taking the settlement of specific disputes out of the hands of the lawyer judges. And finally, or perhaps first of all, it would mean getting rid of the lawyers as lawyers. Getting rid of the lawyers would mean no more legal counsel to talk for you before the courts or commissions or arbitrators or whatever bodies were given the job of handling specific problems in the orderly management of human affairs. People who got involved in disputes or got hauled up for alleged violation of some written law would have to tell their own stories and produce their own proof in the form of written evidence or witnesses or whatever kind of proof was necessary and available. Companies would have to send to court a responsible company official to talk facts and not law. Why not, since the decision makers would no longer be concerned with balancing abstract principles, but only with applying justice straight to the problems before them? not despite what the lawyers will immediately howl. Would it be one whit harder to determine the true facts behind any dispute without the help of the lawyers and their principles of pleading and procedure? As everybody knows, at least one of the lawyers in every case in which the facts are in dispute is out to hide or distort the truth or part of the truth, not to help the court discover it. And his is always able to use the accepted principles to help him do it. The notion that in a clash between two trained principle wielders, one of them is wearing the colors of inaccuracy and falsehood, the truth will always or usually prevail, is in essence nothing but a hangover from the medieval custom of trial by battle, and is in essence equally absurd. Why not let the people really involved in any squabble tell and try to prove to the satisfaction of the decision makers their own lies? Commissions have often found it far easier to discover the true facts behind any dispute by dispensing with the lawyer's rule. Arbitrators have found it easier still by dispensing with the lawyers. Getting rid of the lawyers altogether would also mean no more legal advice for those who can now afford it, and in the making of financial arrangements and the drafting of business documents. People and companies who made financial plans and business agreements would have to word them, or have them worded by non-legal draftsmen, in intelligible language. Why not? Why should not a man who wants to leave his property to his wife at his death say in his will, "I want everything I own to go to my wife when I die," instead of having to hire a lawyer and go through a long rigmarole of legal language? If the written law about wills says, for instance, that three other people have to sign a person's will to help prove later that he signed it, then let the written law be not only intelligible, but as readily available as a guidebook or an article in an encyclopedia. And why should not two people or two companies or a company and a person who want to enter into a business agreement be both entitled and required to state in plain words just what each of them is promising to do or not to do? If constitutions and statutes were all written in ordinary English, and if the lawyer judges were ousted from their decision-making seats, the practicing lawyers would soon automatically disappear. There would be no more use and no more place for their magic. The practical men in charge of dispensing justice would neither understand nor be interested in the abstract principles of the law. Legal language thrown out of the new courtrooms or commission chambers would serve no possible function in the wording of business documents. Neither as advisors out of court nor as representative in court would the lawyers be able to sell their special brand of verbal skill. Then, too, the law schools would be forced to close their doors, or else to turn themselves into schools of practical government or business administration. The breeding of word jugglers would come to an end. Yet it might be just as well to get rid of the lawyers directly, along with the lawyer judges and the legal wording of written laws. At the least, they would have to be voted out of Congress and the state legislatures before it would be possible to redraft constitutions and statutes and set up a decision-making system. And if the lawyers, as lawyers, were abolished directly and immediately, then the other changes would go into effect more smoothly. How to abolish the lawyers directly? Well, why not make the practice of law for money, or for anything else, a crime? The lawyers would, of course, insist that anything so unheard of could only be done by amending the Constitution. But why not amend it? And incidentally, only a lawyer would quibble about what the practice of law meant. Absurd? Preposterous? Think it over for a minute. Suppose a nation were suddenly to wake up to the fact that all its affairs were being supervised and controlled according to the language and principles of astrology by a smart bunch of astrologers. Would making the practice of astrology a crime seem absurd? Go back and read over again the solemn judgment of the Supreme Court of Lawyers in the case of Senior versus Brayton, or pick some other court opinion at random and see where the absurdity lies. Or are we just to go quietly and unquestioningly and stupidly on, submitting the management of our entire civilization to the modern medicine men? The immediate answer is undoubtedly yes, but it need not be a permanent answer. And if any popular movement to get rid of the lawyers and their law and to put our system of social control on a common sense basis should ever make enough headway for the lawyers to have to face it instead of scoffing at it, their chief arguments against it, other than those already considered, would probably boil down to two. They would argue in the first place that even if the time-tested legal system with all its principles and its precedents were scrapped and another sort of system set up in its place, the new system would soon develop its principles and its precedents too, and even its special language. Now, if the new system were put in the hands of lawyers or of men trained and skilled principally in abstract logic, that would unquestionably be so. But it would not be so if the new system were entrusted, as it would be entrusted, to men trained and skilled in coping with practical human problems. And it would particularly not be so if those in charge of the new system were aware, as they would be aware, that there need be no pretense of preordained certainty and consistency about their decisions, taken in the mass, but rather a direct effort to deal intelligently and justly with each problem or dispute as it came along. Finally, the lawyers would argue that if the law were scrapped and it became generally known that fallible men rather than infallible and impersonal abstract principles were dictating decisions which other men had to obey, then all respect for law and order would vanish, and revolution or anarchy or both would ensue. But in this argument, a typical magician's argument, and its conjuring up of frightful imagery, hobgoblins, is displayed a strange and contemptuous mistrust of the civilized tendencies of the nation. It implies that the whole structure of our society would automatically go to pieces if it were put on a practical rather than a mystical basis, an unwarranted assumption at best. Moreover, in this argument lies the crux of the whole fraud of the law. For the average man's respect, such as it is, for our present system of law and his consequent willingness to let his life be run in mysterious fashion by the lawyers are indeed founded on the carefully nurtured legend that legal principles are just about infallible and that they produce in the judge's hands something very close to certain justice, which, to sum it all up in four words, they aren't and don't. It is a blind respect born not of understanding, but of fear. And the fear is built on ignorance. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the last, with one last comment. If only the average man could be led to see and know the cold truth about the lawyers and their law, with the ignorance would go the fear. With the fear would go the respect. Then indeed, and doubtless in orderly fashion too, it would be. Woe unto you, lawyers. What I have read is a book that was written by Fred Rodell, spelled R-O-D-E-L-L, a professor of law at Yale University. This was written in 1939, 75 years ago this year. It is titled, Woe Unto You, Lawyers. It can be found on the internet. You can Google it and you can find it. But I think as most of you that have read or listened to me read will agree, what he said 75 years ago about the law applies just as much today as it did then, about it being nothing but hocus pocus and a way to control an entire country and planet.